We on? Now then, Ray Winston here. The real one. Close enough. Doing a new podcast with me mate Tony. Soprano, that is.
Oh, how you doing?
Talking all the big stuff. Birds, scraps, films.
And of course, men's mental health. With studio guests such as arch feminist and top broad Deborah Francis White and disgraced scumbag comedian Dapper Laughs.
Something for everyone. We're trying to be better men, ain't we, Tone?
That's right. We're bad boys done good.
Available on YouTube and to download on all good audio platforms. Go on, get off your hands, you dopey c***.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the best podcast in tiers 1, 2 and 3, Insane in the Membrane.
Insane in the Membrane.
Hi again. It's that time again. I love this. You love this. Let's do it. But before we do it, I need to tell you about my radio show on Islington Radio, now available on Mixcloud, bringing you some of the best music from down the ages. We cover all bases. You need to get involved because I have great taste in music and I know that you will enjoy it. So get onto that, Islington Radio, it's on Mixcloud right now. Hi guys, welcome again to the show. I hope you're all right, hope you're well. Still mad, confusing times. We've had the update today. I don't really know what we're allowed to do, what we're allowed not to do. I don't know. I know we're doing it so we don't kill each other. So that's why it's happening. We've got to remember that. I hope you're doing okay. If you're not, drop me a line. We'll have a chat. Because I've got to be honest, I've had a bit of a wobble this week. It gets like that sometimes, doesn't it? And then I come in here and I have a chat with some wonderful guests. And it feels better. Next week on Insane in the Fembrain, we've got the brilliant Zoe Lyons. And it's been an absolute joy to speak to her. It really did fire me up. She's such a wonderful woman. So that was cool. That'll be coming to you next week. Also coming up on this very podcast, we've got Jamie Green and Tom Aldridge. Now, Jamie Green, you won't have heard of. Some comedians might have met Jamie in Edinburgh and around about the places. Jamie is a wheelchair user, but he gets stuck in. That boy does not let that thing slow him down. He gets about, and you would have seen him in Edinburgh taking in all the shows. And Tom Aldridge. Tom Aldridge played Ron Weasley, or is playing Ron Weasley, in the stage show Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. And it was great to have Tom on. That's coming at you in the next couple of weeks. And like I say, it's a bit like Jamie. You know, it's not all about names. It's, you know, I like to have people on that are interesting and not necessarily famous. Just because I want to change it up a little bit and have people on that are interesting. You know, I've always said that, interesting people, and take a punt, have a listen. I think you'll be suitably impressed. So do that for us. And so this week, my guest. I'm a huge fan, have been for many years. His book Things Snowball came out in 2002. One of the funniest books I've ever read. I do talk about it in the episode briefly. Honestly, if you haven't got it, get it on eBay or Amazon. It'll only cost you a couple of quid. Go and get yourself this book. It is absolutely brilliant. Rich Hall, a fantastic comedian. One of those, again, that you kind of, I watch him work and I'm like, oh yeah, that's what I aspire to. You know, like, You know, and I try. I know. I think I kept the sycophancy down. I don't think I bum licked too much. I think I kept a lid on it. I was just so excited to get him on and have a chat. So you will hear in the background. You will hear kids and dogs coming in, and so yeah, that's just life happening around our guest at the moment. So anyway, coming up in just a sec is Rich Hall.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
A podcast from producer Paul.co.uk.
How you been anyway? Are you well?
Yeah, I'm all right. I got back to the UK in late September, and I was doing some stuff on weekends, but that's been curtailed for a while. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe might start back soon again, I'm hoping.
I hope so. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. They've just announced the new lockdown things again. It just changes all the time. I didn't realize how much I enjoyed making plans.
Right.
You know, and now you can't. You kind of you go, oh, maybe I'll be able to do that in March, but I don't know. You have to. It's weird. It's a weird time, isn't it? We're just, yeah. You can't plan anything. You can't go anywhere.
Yeah.
You just got to sit. Just sit
it's
and
like
wait.
Being trapped in a cabin in the North Woods. Just trying to find ways to entertain yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, there's no excuse not to stay busy. You know, there's certainly if you're a comedian or a writer, then you can always just keep producing. You just have no outlet for trying it out, but we will, you know.
Yeah, eventually. Yeah. Yeah. We were talking about that before. I was talking about that before on another episode about that. Yeah. And this won't be this way forever. It will eventually. We will move back into maybe the comedy circuit won't be as it was, but there'll still be dark corners where we can stand and say stuff.
Yeah, it'll be like comedy has been made illegal.
Yeah, like the speakeasies. But you grew up in, is it North Carolina?
I grew up in Kentucky in North Carolina, yeah.
Yeah, how was that? Because I have no experience of that. I've been to New York and I've been to LA and Vegas. Yeah. But I haven't really traveled around much. What was it like in North Carolina?
The South is, you know, I have a special affinity for the South because I grew up there. And it's very, you know, probably the cliches you've heard about it are probably pretty evident. Slightly, I don't know, Southerners have a kind of sense of, like, we have a way of doing things and people up north are you know, we have our own kind of, you know, internal logic. I think, you know, the comedian Jeff Foxworthy, who used to do that whole, you might be a redneck if, was kind of all based on the Southern attitude that like, well, you know, things might be, you know, intellectual and really fancy up north, but there's just good old, you know, Southern logic to get by in the South. And though I never really much appreciated Jeff Foxworthy's jokes, I knew exactly where they were coming from, and I knew why they resonated so well in the South, you know, because Southerners, very, very proud people and very proud of their hospitality. That's one thing that's great about
it. Yeah, I was going to say that. They seem very generous.
Yeah, when you go to a place like New Orleans, they have a word called Laniap, which means something for nothing, and literally means, you know, if you go to a restaurant or something, they'll bring out something that you hadn't ordered, and they love doing that. They love seeing people having a good time and people going away happy, you know. And that's one of my favorite cities, New Orleans, just for that reason.
Yeah, I love that. And this is the thing: we only know what's fed to us, you know, via the news and especially at the moment, you know. And movies, And I did, that's the thing. When I was in America, I was in Poughkeepsie. I was doing Bananas in Poughkeepsie. And I'm wandering around Poughkeepsie and I'm like, wow, I feel like I'm on a set. It was fucking great. But these things don't really get talked about. Like, you know, with especially the way things are at the minute, whenever we see America, it's always this fighting and it's all the bullshit with Trump.
Yeah.
Which is insane. That won't fuck off, will he?
Well, he'll be pushed into the margins eventually. He already is, but I think he's going to have, you know, it's like the Tea Party, but even stronger. He's going to have his followers for years, and he's going to be able to manipulate the politics, particularly, you know, right wing politics, and it's going to be hard for anyone to even contemplate running against him, because he already seems to be the designated candidate for 2024, which is probably not going to work. In 4 years, I just can't see him. I can't see him expanding his base any more than it is now. You know, I like to think that Biden, even though he may be just a sort of normal, you know, meat and potatoes kind of guy, is people are just so drawn to a sense of normalcy again. You know,
Well, that was it. Yeah, it was just it didn't matter who it was, as long as it wasn't Trump.
Yeah, to a certain degree. And he played it very well, Joe Biden. He just kind of stayed holed up in his basement and sent out missives and just kept focusing on the positive side of things. And to a certain degree, it worked, although it's frightening how many votes Trump still got. I mean, he got 74 million votes or something like that, which...
Wow.
I believe makes him the biggest loser in presidential history.
That's terrifying, isn't it? That despite all the evidence, people just went, nah, he's still the man. He's still the guy.
Yeah. And I have a real affinity for rural people. You know, I live in Montana now and I'm so many people I know are, you know, ranchers and agrarian types, and they're fantastic people, you know, and you just kind of have learned to avoid politics, but these are the people who vote for Trump. And it strikes me, I can't quite square in my head what they see in him, you know, because they're probably, you know, farmers, ranchers are very virtuous people, you know, they pride themselves on it. And yet they've somehow managed to decide that they prefer this guy. You know, it might just be a huge distrust of big government and all the things that Trump claimed to be against, they stand behind him, you know. And I can't quite figure it out, because Republicans are for the most part decent people, you know, and just they have very specific values, and you kind of respect that. But somehow Trump he got him on his side. I can't explain. Even as an American, even as someone who's fairly astute about, you know, what's going on in the country, I can't quite figure that part out.
No, it's like over here with Boris Johnson. You kind of know. Boris did really well on Have I Got News for You? And then it went. That was it. Everyone's like, oh, yeah, no, he's fine. We enjoyed him. He's a buffoon. And then the buffoon took charge. You're like, no, you don't need a buffoon in charge. This is fucked now.
I don't know. I don't understand what I don't understand the political mind, you know. I don't understand, you know, the old saying, politics is for, is show business for ugly people. Maybe that's it. Maybe you get caught up in that. But I, you know, it's so transparent to me. And part of the problem that we're, that this country and America is suffering right now is that we tend to let the government dictate what we're going to do, even though we know inside that we know as much about what's going on as they do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's it. These are elected by us, these people, in order to run things in our name. And that gets lost, doesn't it? It's like, you're we're not working for you. You're working for us.
I know. But you don't get a chance to say to their face. I tried to talk to Michael Gove once, and he just slagged me off. You know, it was at one of those garden shows, at the Chelsea Flower Show I end up at every year, even though I have no interest in it. And but I always get to go on press day before, you know, the throng show up. And I hate Michael Gove. I hate him basically because he doesn't like he's not a fan of Steinbeck, and he tried to get the book thrown out of the curriculum, you know.
What?
Grapes of Wrath. Yeah. And I've always held that against him. And I didn't start out well because I said, Michael Gove, what an asshole. So it's not a good starting point. But then I tried, you know, then I just tried to launch into a, you know, just to see where he was coming from. He was waiting for a car to pick him up and he had nowhere to go. So I just engaged him and
he wouldn't have it.
He's very surly.
Yeah, wanker. So you're back in Montana?
No, I'm in London right now.
Yeah. Right, okay. But you've moved, you saying you live in there now, you've gone back, you come back and forth.
A lot, yeah.
And do you find that, is it nice having that to go back to, just that?
It's not only nice to go back to, it's also, you know, the insanity of living in a big city, particularly in a foreign, which is still a foreign country to me, you know. Sometimes just having that in the back of my head that I know I have a place to go and I look forward to going back there is fantastic. Doesn't mean I have to be there all the time. You can't.
No, but it's nice to have that.
Yeah, experience. Because I thrive on crowds, and you don't get those in Montana. You're not going to.
No.
You get herds. You get more herds than crowds. So in terms of keeping a mental balance, a stable mental balance, that works for me.
It's not. I know what you mean. I've spoken about this before where someone has said to me, do you like being on your own? And I'm like, yeah, I do, but it's because I know I've got things to go back to. So I'm all right for a bit, but I know in the back of my mind I've got friends and I've got places I can be where I'm amongst everyone. I think if I didn't have that, then I'd probably struggle a bit more on my own.
Yeah.
You know? But I was telling this to producer Paul just now. I tell this to everybody. Your book, Things Snowball, which I know is like nearly 18 years ago now, is one of the funniest books I've ever read.
Thanks.
And it was one of the few books I've read where I was reading it on the train and laughing out loud. And it was the stepladder.
Oh, yeah.
When you were explaining the fact that there's all these rules to operate a stepladder, but there's only like five to operate a nuclear power plant.
Yeah.
And I just, it's one of the best books ever. Where did the stories come from? Are they just been kicking around for ages?
I think a few had, and a few would just be, I go out for a run or something, realize, and I had to fill this book up, and ideas would just pop into my head, you know, like the germ of an idea, and then I'd go back and work it out in print. So, some were biographical, some were just, you know, pulled them out of my ass, basically. And I went back and looked at it, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, and I think the problem with writing books of short pieces is that when you go back and look at them later, you see the ones that stand out and you see the ones that you think, oh, man, I just phoned that one in, you know. But you have no idea of how people are going to respond. So I did that, and then I wrote some other books after that, and I'm working on another book now, which is basically kind of really heavily fictionalized biography. Oh, well, really? Not a biography, not in the sense of, not in the normal biographical sense of a linear progression, but it's called Nine Gigs, and it's about nine different things that I've done in my career that struck me as just, you know, maybe not career changing or career propelling, but just crazy performances, you know, for whatever reason. From not only from being on stage, but from writing or traveling around, you know, before I was a comedian. And so they're just kind of, I don't know, it sort of jumps back and forth, you know, it's not.
It's not linear. Like I say, it's just back.
I haven't really decided in what order they're going. They don't necessarily start out with me in my first gig or anything like that. You know, I'm not sure. That might be up to the publishers to decide. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. And is it true? It's like you say, it's a biography.
Well, it's a memoir. It's a memoir. Yeah.
Yeah.
But since it's, I mean, what I found is that nobody, if you're, you know, trying to write a biography, you don't remember where you were when things happened or what exactly was said. So there's a tremendous amount of license involved, you know, because I'm trying to describe my first Edinburgh or my first writing gig or something. And, you know, I can't remember, you know, I didn't take extensive notes at the time. I didn't really keep diaries. So I've just gone back and so the incidents are true, but it's highly reimagined. But the thing about that is, as opposed to just writing a book of just whatever, you know, comes to mind and throwing it at the wall, I have an idea of what what I need to write about, you know, and it's just a matter of trying to get it all in order. So I like that part.
As I say, do you like the writing? Do you enjoy?
I do. Yeah, that's a great thing for lockdown. Down. It's really, because I started in the summer, and so it's really kind of taken over, and it's probably the best thing to replace getting to go on stage, you know. Because it takes a lot of, you kind of get, I think when you're writing a book, you really get caught up in it. And everybody around you just, you know, my family, they all know I'm working on it. So they just think, his head's somewhere else right now. You know, they steer clear of me.
Just let you get on with it. Just come and relight the candle.
Yeah, you can get away with making people think you're working even though you're staring out the window.
I've said that before. I was in a past relationship and she came in and she went, "What have you been doing all day?" I'm like, it's not going to make any sense if I tell you. She's like, "But you are where you were when I left you this morning." I'm like, "Hey, I was trying to think of what a funny number is. What is a funny number?" And she's like, "Oh, you're a fucking idiot."
I know. Yeah, that's the bane. That's the bane of any artist is that you're not going to be understood. Nor is it a tap you can just turn on and go, I'm going to go work for 4 hours. I'll be back in 4 hours. I'm going to go write comedy for 4 hours. No, you'll sit there and do nothing. And then it'll all come in a flurry, you know?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, normally it's all, when you're about to do something else or you're about to go to sleep or do something and you go and your brain goes, there's that bit you were missing from that idea you had. Like, fuck.
Yeah.
All right, come on in.
Yeah. There are weeks where nothing happens and then there's hours where weeks happen when you're writing.
And you can't, and like you say, you can't control it. It just happens and you have to just go with it.
No, but I find that to have a gun to your head, whether that's a paycheck or a deadline, does help, you know? Really helps. Yeah. If someone says, I need this article or I need this book or whatever by Friday, then you don't have the time or the excuse to just lay around and let it ruminate, you know. You really have to go after it, and I think that's good.
I had that same conversation with my partner Jade Adams, and in the lockdown, and she was like, she's got scripts to write and she's got deadlines and this and that. And then she was like, oh, you could get on with your book idea or this idea. And I'm like, yeah, but no one's asking for
yeah.
it. That's yeah. the difference. Like you've got someone ringing you up going, where is it?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I've got people go, if I go, I go, well, what's this?
Yeah.
And that, yeah. So you're right in that respect. Yeah.
When I worked on Saturday Night Live, you had to have what you wanted to get into the show. You had to have by Tuesday night or a Wednesday morning read through. So you'd come in Monday morning and you had basically 2 days to come up with, you know, something wonderful yeah. right away. And, that was an experience because quite often I did finally come up with something.
Mm. You must have been constantly having to think of stuff. Like, even like you say, it's, you've got to get it ready by Tuesday.
Yeah, well, it's just a form of concentration, you know. When you really, yeah. really need something, an idea, then more times than not, I found that something will come along, if you know.
Yeah. That I don't, yeah, I suppose it's training yourself, isn't it, as well? Because I know sometimes I'll sit down and go, right, now I'm going to write something, and I'll just stare yeah. at nothing. I'm like, yeah. And then the pressure starts building up, and then the voices start like, well, you're shit anyway. You go, not
yeah.
now.
But it's like fishing. It's like if you just throw your line into the water and wiggle it around, you know, something might just pop up anyway, which you had no idea. Which would never have occurred to you, you know, randomly. Because you've yeah. made some effort, you see, oh, well, oh yeah, here's the crux of what I'm trying to do. I find that in songwriting yeah, a lot. I'll sit down and try to write a song about one thing, and then a certain line will come along, and I'll realize, no, that's the essence of the song, and it might change completely, you know. The whole idea might change yes. completely, but now I have a focal point.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I can tell.
I don't understand. You know, people who I've met comedians who say, "Oh, I went to a comedy class," and I don't know how you can. I don't know how you can teach comedy.
No, you can teach people how to put words in the yeah. right way,
and I guess you can teach them,
yeah,
how to overcome some shyness, stage fright, or whatever. Or you can talk about it in any way. But the only way to become a comedian is to just do it. Just do it. Just
yeah.
go up there and either. You're going to do well, in which case you'll be encouraged, or you're going to do awful, in which case you're either going to say, I never want to do this again, or I'm going to go back and work and show these bastards next time, you know?
Yeah. I remember talking to Mike Wilmot in the early days, and I said to him in a green room, I'm like, you know what? I love the fact that you just come out and you just start talking. I wish I could do that. And he went, well, just walk out and start
yeah.
talking. And, oh, yeah.
yeah.
I thought that was for everybody else and not for me. It was like always looking at you guys and going, oh, I'd love to do that. And you go, well, fucking do
yeah.
it then.
yeah, Dan Aykroyd was on, I was watching him on, I think it was Seth Meyers. He had, and Dan Aykroyd was never a stand-up comedian. He came out of Second City in Toronto. But he said... He just starts talking to Seth, and he just says, you know, I Seth, you know, I used to host the Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live, and you hosted the Weekend Update, and you were much better than I was. And I'm sure you, blah, blah, blah. I'm sure you get people coming up to you asking you, how do I get started in this business? And Seth says, yeah, I do. And then Dan says, well, I've got some, you know, people still come up to me all the time and ask me how to get started. And so I have some advice. And his advice, which you'd think would be like, go on a stage, learn improv, you know, or learn stand up. He yeah. said, go to the Comedy Museum in Jamestown, New York. And that's the hometown of Lucille Ball. And they have a comedy museum there. And when you come out of that, you'll know what it's like to be a comedian. And then read Steve Martin's biography. And oh, then yeah. read John Lithgow's biography, because that's a great biography. I went, John Lithgow's not even, what? He's like an actor. And why would you go to a museum? And I'm just sitting there thinking, this is the worst advice. the comedy, if I went to Jamestown, the Comedy Museum wouldn't even be the first thing I would go to see. And furthermore, like if you really wanted to be a comedian, don't go to the Comedy Museum, go to the, go on a tour of the crappiest, weirdest, most, you know, out there museums, the Museum of Salt Shakers or something. That's where you'll find comedy. You'll come out of that with a story.
Yeah. There's a chair museum in Wycombe. Yeah. And I've never been, but I drive past this sign. I'm like, one day I'm going to go and look at the chairs.
I know. If nothing else, just to see who's the guy. You want to meet the guy who's just, you know, saved up all these chairs and goes to bed every night thinking, oh, I got to get my hands on that Gustav Stickley piece of furniture from that Amish community in upstate New York. If I could just get that, my collection would be complete.
It's got this room on its own, ready. All the lights in position, ready for his chair.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of obscure museums.
There was one. There's a postcard museum, and I say museum. It was a cupboard, and just had these. It just had postcards up, and they weren't even written on. And I'm just like, these are just old postcards.
I've been to a Salt and Shaker museum. I've been to a pencil museum. I've been to a museum of ambulatory objects, which was roller skates, pogo sticks, everything. And they're hilarious. It's a great museum in it's actually a broom closet, basically, called KDK's in Nashville, which is just all the old gabardine suits that country and western stars used to wear. You know, all the sequins and pearls. And they weigh about, like, the coat weighs about 20 pounds. And this is before air conditioning. These guys used to go out in the heat in Tennessee wearing these things, and you just think, how did they not die? And it's just a whole collection of them. Nudie suits, Nudie the tailor, the guy who used to do all Elvis' stuff. A lot of those in there. It's fantastic.
Oh, I love that. When you look at those guys, the country and western guys, the country music guys, the outfits were just so out there.
I know.
And the hair as well. When you see pictures, Conway
Twitty and Porter Wagoner. Oh, yeah. Brilliant.
And Conway's hair, you're like, how? I don't even know where that starts. He's got his, like, candy floss, like this cotton candy thing going on. And you're just like,
oh, yeah. Wow. It was a golden age.
Yeah. Is Lee Crenshaw. Oh. Did he come from that?
Otis pretty much came from, he was sort of an amalgam of all the relatives that we didn't have over for Christmas because they were so scary. I got a lot of people. I got a lot of people in my family tree from, you know, grew up in the South, in the woods, trailer parks, that kind of stuff. And so it wasn't hard for me to put that character together.
No, and there was something familiar.
Well, it was certainly familiar. It was I could channel him so easily that all I really had to do was just make him funny, you know.
Yeah, and that's a sign of a great character, isn't it? That you start referring to that character as a person.
Yeah, and you think like him, and you think, oh, what would they do in this situation? How would they respond to it? And those are hard to come by, you know. Because I'm not a great character comedian by any stretch. I have a limited vocal range and limited ability to mime or impersonate other people. But I never had any problem with Otis.
No, he nailed it. Absolutely nailed it. I loved it. My dad is a huge fan of Otis Lee Crenshaw.
Oh, good.
Yeah, loves it. He loves you. Yeah, he's a huge fan. But you wrote on Letterman as well, early in the days.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
How was that? Was that the same sort of pressure as SNL?
No. Not at all. It was more because you're writing for someone else, and I could write in his voice. I could write in Letterman's voice. I think we had, you know, the same sensibilities as far as comedy goes. And it was the first show I wrote on was live, and it was on in the morning, and it was just like the head writer, his name was Meryl Marco, just came in and just said, well, let's just she said, we only have one rule, and that is we're at war with the whole motif of daytime television, you know, the game shows and all that. So that's what we did. We just made a show that just was kind of rubbing the whole morning viewership. We were kind of rubbing their noses in it, and we sort of attracted this, you know, big college audience, university audience, and the kind of people who don't normally watch morning television. And it didn't really get the big numbers. It got huge complaints. Well, for every fan later, there was like 20 letters to the head of NBC just saying, what the fuck? Where's The Price is Right? Why did you? Because we replaced three morning game shows, and people were livid.
Yeah. Wow. And this is in 1980, yeah, so it was a lot more starchy, a lot more stiff upper sort of.
Yeah. But part of it, I mean, we were doing a nighttime show for daytime people, and that was the problem. So it was evident that the show belonged on late at night. And then once it went to late night, of course, it, you know, it was massively successful. Yeah. Huge. But that show was just, you'd write stuff. You'd have all day to write stuff, and then it was meant to be throwaway humor. You know, I've always, when I first got over here, I wondered why there wasn't a late night, 5-night-a-week talk show on in Britain. I know they've tried it a few times, and it was awful. And I just thought, you know, in London, there's certainly no shortage of guests, and there's no shortage of writers, and there's just no shortage. You could easily pull that off, but it took me a long time to realize that that's not how Brits watch TV. They don't watch TV lying in bed, you know, staring at it between their toes, waiting to go to sleep the way you watch a lot of late night talk shows. So they don't do that, you know. So,
No. They have to get involved in it and immersed, and it has to mean something.
Yeah.
It's not, like I say, it's not as throwaway.
No, but because it was, then there was always this sense that the jokes you were doing, it's like, well, if it doesn't work, it's not the end of the world. We'll come up with something tomorrow, you know. And Letterman had a great way of just, if something didn't work, he just, you know, he would make fun of that. So there was no pressure. It was great when you came up with something that really worked and something that could be repeated, you know. But I remember on the morning show when it was first struggling and we didn't even really have a producer. The head writer was pretty much producing the show. And she just said, why don't we just bring in our dogs and show them and let them do some tricks. And that turned into this segment called Stupid Pet Tricks that went on for 20 years and was massively popular. It was just people would bring their pets in and they would come out and just do whatever they did. And, you know, you'd have dogs who could answer a phone, and it was great, and it was just so simple.
Yeah, and it went for 20 years. And was there pressure? There was pressure to come up with stuff, but was that when they went, oh, we're not using that, was there, I briefly wrote on something last year, and I was sat in the studio while they were filming it, and the main woman came through, and she said to me and the other guy, and she went, right, well, I need 10 jokes on this subject. I need them now. And we had to run off to this room and come up with them. And then we were all pleased with ourselves. We were laughing at them in the room. Oh, these are great, these are great, these are great. And we gave them to her. And she went, nah, not using that now. We're doing this. And it was, you had to get to that point, you go, it's not personal.
No, you got to learn that right away. That it's, you know, you may think it's great. Your buddies might think it's great. Your co-writers might think it's great. The host just doesn't feel comfortable doing it. The host wants to do it and it doesn't work. And then they look at you. Like it's, you know, what did you give me this for? No, Letterman was never really like that. He was, if you could make him laugh, he would do it, you know. And whether or not it worked, he didn't hold it against you.
No, and that's the thing with Letterman. He just has that air of, you know, we'll do it. If it doesn't work, we'll just do something else. He cared, but he didn't. It wasn't like the end of the world.
No, he would quite often. Yeah. I think the thing that he said the most was, he'd just go, "It's only television." He was right. Yes. You know? And that attitude was certainly what came through. You would watch Letterman, and he kind of got rid of all that sort of Johnny Carson kind of fake. Oh, we're all buddies off screen. You know, Letterman. Yeah. Everyone knew Letterman had no friends.
At least he was honest, and he didn't like you say, he didn't pretend.
He changed the whole in slight ways, the actual format itself, which is a crazy format, which in the sense that if you're a comedian, there's a guy at a desk and the guy introduces you and then you come out and you do your airtight 6-minute monologue. And then you go over and you sit in proximity to the desk, you know, but that kind of, pecking order is very well established, that I'm behind the desk. You will never be behind the desk. You will sit beside the desk. And then as a comedian, you just think, I fucking never wanted a desk job in the first place. That's why I became a comedian. But that's probably the primary route to comedic success in America is through doing these 6-minute spots on talk shows until eventually everybody forgets your jokes, but they eventually remember your face and you go, oh, that guy's funny. I'll go see him when he plays, you know, Sir Laughs a Lot or P.O. Pants or whatever the stupid club is you're at. There's no shortage. There was no shortage. Not as many as there used to be, but it reached a point where every town had a comedy club and you could make a really good living doing it, you know, but it was the same. It really got old. That's why I came over here.
Right. And how did you find it when you first got over here?
The first thing was I was astounded that you could, that the structure of the, that you could come over here and the shows were structured differently, because in America it's the MC, then the middle act, then you. And the MC does 10 minutes, which is all local jokes about the nearest crap town and the local slag watering hole. And then the middle act comes out and does this drivel that with where it segues. You need a fucking neck brace just to, you know, just shoots from one thing to another. And then you go on and you do your 45 minutes. But the waitresses are running around because people are ordering jalapeno poppers and chili platters.
That's it.
And it's a 2-drink minimum. So they've already been basically raped before they even come in the door with the 2-drink minimum. Even if you don't drink alcohol, you have to buy 2 drinks. So there's a ticket price. There's a drink minimum imposed on you. There's food. There's surly wait staff. And then while you're on stage trying to, you know, kind of build to some, big finish, the waitresses drop the checks on the table and everybody's settling up, as I'm sure you discovered in whatever it was in Poughkeepsie, you know. People are paying. There's like credit cards just waving around, fluttering around in the wind like sails while you're trying to, you know, trying to work up your big finish. And then they kind of settle the tab. And then there's about 3 minutes where they kind of turn back and look at you. And now they're thinking, I just paid this amount of money. You better have something great. You know, it's a tremendous amount of pressure. And when I got over here, I found that, first of all, there aren't all those blenders going off in the back and mixed drinks and waitresses. People buy a beer, they sit down, they watch somebody, and then there's a break. They go buy another beer, they come back, they sit down, and they completely reset. And it's so simple. Yes. Nor, you know, for the most part, and these can be anywhere. This can be in a pub. Nobody is just rake, you know, nobody's forked over $500,000 to call some place the Improv or which they were doing in America when the Improv and Laugh Factory started franchising their names. You'd have to pay $200,000 or $300,000 to use that name.
Wow.
So that's your investment before you even brought anybody in to watch a show. Just thinking that the name itself, the Improv, is going to bring people in. And I never could. And yet there are other clubs, you know, that are just have a reputation for always having a good show. And those clubs have survived.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That's kind of true here, you know. There's so many great places, especially in London, that are just they're not overly ambitious. The guys running them or the ladies running them are just trying to put on quality shows. And that was the first thing I noticed, was just this ability of Brits to sort of hit the reset button, you know, dismiss the last guy, or even if the last guy was fantastic, they're still willing to see what you have to say, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, they don't do that. I remember doing Ha Comedy Club in New York. And then they were saying, oh, right, you're going there. Oh, and they were going, Rich, you've got checks. You've got checks tonight. And I'm like, what's that? And that's when I discovered what that meant.
Yeah.
And I was brand new. And I'm standing there just with my dick in my head going, ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'll tell you what, it was character building. It makes you, when you gig out of your comfort zone,
Well, that's what I found when I came here. I was completely out of my comfort zone. But what I had was, it wasn't like I didn't know what I was doing. I knew exactly what I was doing. It was just a completely different setting. And it was more conducive to what I wanted to do. You know, I'm not slick. I think a lot of American comedians and very good ones are also very, very polished. And that's actually what you appreciate about them. And here there was something rough around the edges that I think was more, that shows more of the personality of the comedian, you know, as opposed to just being this vehicle for some really well-written material. You can kind of, they just kind of come through, you know? And I think that seemed more genuine, you know?
Yeah, that's like when I've seen you and you bridge that, you managed to get that, bridge the gap, or that it's like a hot pot of honesty, and then a little bit, and then it gets a little bit surreal.
Yeah.
But it's, there's an honesty there about what you're doing. You're just telling stories, and they go off. It seems to go off where you don't even know where it's going to go half the time. You just kind of off.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's a joy to watch, because like you say, you don't see that all the time.
Yeah. Well, that's what I like doing, because I don't want every show to be the same. I couldn't go out there every night and do the same show word for word.
Oh man, you're going.
Some people operate that way, you know. They will tape their shows and go back to their room after the show and listen to it over and over. The last thing I want to hear is my voice again after I've been on stage. And if something strikes me as, oh, I'll try to remember something that, you know, that really worked that I hadn't done before. And sometimes it's not meant to be repeated. You've got to give the audience a sense that you just didn't breeze in and you're phoning in the same damn show. You know, that would drive me crazy.
Oh man, it's funny what you say. I've had again that very conversation with my partner Jade, and she said, "Oh, you should record it. You should record it, because you always say something different." And I, but I'll say something different next time as well. If I'm listening back to what I've just done, it's going to lose that essence.
I think so. But it depends. It all depends on your approach, you know. Music is much, much more structured. And I've been the last few years doing tons of music in my show, and you're married to a band, you know, you're married to what they're playing. Mm-hmm. And in between the songs, you know, there's quite a lot of improvising, you know, how I'm going to get into it. But once you're into the song, you've got to go, you know, the band has been, they've rehearsed this and they practice it, and you know, you can't just start adding extra measures, because everyone will lose their place. And
true.
So you got to stick to a pretty strict format, and it's good. I appreciate that, you know, but I also like not having to rely on that.
When you're on your own, you can just cut loose.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what do you make of it now? I mean, it seems to be, whereas before, it just, all you had to do was be funny. Comedians just needed to be funny. But now it seems to be we need to jump on causes and push things rather than just comedy.
I don't know.
And it, you know, and it, not to disrespect, I'm not, no disrespect to anybody, but it sometimes feels like we're losing that. Just be funny. That's all you got
to
do.
There's a bit of trickery to that, because, you know, it's not that different than American comedians who give you their credentials before you're introduced. Thinking that, oh, he's been on this and this, and we need to know this, because that means that we should respect him more and pay attention, that he's probably going to be funny. And you're really trying to just buy the audience's good graces, you know? And I think it's the same when people get on to certain platforms and throw things in that are just like, oh, all right. Yeah, okay, we get it. Yeah. It's too funny. I mean, watch Mike Wilmot. He doesn't do any of that shit. He just comes out.
No.
And he's the guy holding up the end of the bar. Even Bill Burr is like that. Bill Burr is just the loudmouth at the bar who happens to have really funny opinions, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what you see. And they're not on any, you know, they're not pushing any other agenda than making people laugh.
Yeah. And I think just by listening to them, you can work out what their politics are, what the kind of a person they are. They don't need to flag it up.
Nor do you even want to. Well, I don't see the point of pigeonholing yourself in any sense, you know. Let people make their own impressions of you, because you don't know what impression they've really come away with. All you hear is the laughs, and you know, well, that must be pretty funny. And you're not even, sometimes, you know, I'm sure you've noticed, sometimes you say things, do things that weren't even the intended punchline of the joke and are much funnier.
Yeah. Yeah, there's been a couple of times I've gone, well, I didn't even know I was going to say that.
And then you realize, oh, I guess that, when you hear people laugh, you kind of think, oh, why are they laughing at that? What did I say? And then you realize that you said something that just struck to you, you know, you know what's under the iceberg, you know everything that makes it up. They've just seen the tip of the iceberg, and they laugh because they were surprised by it. And it seemed perfectly normal. Well, I just assumed you knew that, but they don't. They know very little about you. And the less they know about you, the better.
Yeah, true. Yeah. That's the thing now, isn't it, with social media. We know everything about everybody, and I miss the mystery. I miss that, you know, like your rock stars lived on another planet.
Yeah.
And I miss that mystery.
Well, I used to love watching Mitch Hedberg, because he never, it was all one-liners. And yet by the end of it, you could see that there was this guy who had a really strange way of looking at things, of really ordinary stuff. He would pass us, you know, he would just do jokes about seeing a dry cleaning sign saying, sorry, we're closed, you know, at 3 a.m. And it becomes this whole thing about, you know, why would you put that sign up? And that tells you more about him, as much about him as it does about the joke. He never revealed anything about himself.
But there was
such a strong personality behind those jokes.
Yeah, for sure. And then when if a joke didn't work, you go, all right. let's do another one.
Yeah, exactly.
did you know Mitch?
Yeah. Not really, because he was pretty well. I mean, we worked together quite often.
Yeah, because even that was just, you know, I know he was he liked to enjoy himself.
He did, yeah.
But it's still a shock that when
it was. Although he was in pretty bad shape. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I got some kids have just come home.
How old are you?
1-7, but he's got a couple of friends over.
Oh, nice.
Good. They're going into the other room.
When you were growing up, because like you say, yeah, there was the Southern hospitality, there's that. But also, are people open with their feelings when you were growing up? I know they were, in this country, they're not so much. Like men especially were like, you got to be a man and you keep that shit down and you just get on with your life. Or was that the same with you?
There was certainly a sense of kind of chivalry, I suppose, male chivalry, male pride, hunting, fishing, you know, country boy kind of stuff. And I suppose in a way that manifests itself as not opening up your true feelings, you know.
Yeah.
But it was just get on with it, you know, which.
Yeah.
If there's a problem,
I think,
go after it. Figure it out, you know.
I think I was talking to someone the other day, and they were saying, you know, it's taken us years to get men to open up, and now we can't shut you up.
Yeah.
I suppose you have to find that balance.
Yeah.
Don't you?
And it depends. You know. It's friends and relatives. You can, you know, you can see what's going on with them, but people you don't know so well, I can't say that men in the South were guarded. They certainly weren't guarded, you know, about their feelings, but I think it just didn't really, you know, they would talk cars, they talked fishing, they talked, you know, sports.
Yeah.
And just kept it, you know, kept it level, kept it on the level.
Yeah. I think it could, on a basic level, because cars now are so modern and you just plug them into a computer and the computer tells you what's wrong with it. My dad, most weekends, would be underneath the car. And then the neighbours would come over and they'd be talking. Yeah. And that's how men would communicate. That's how they would get rid of their stress. And like you say, sports, cars. And that's what they did. And that's been taken away now. You don't have that, which I think is a shame.
Oh, you don't?
Yeah, not really. No, you don't really get. Does it seem to be like guys underneath their cars on a Sunday?
Oh no, no, no! They're watching. They're watching races on TV. Yeah, no, it's too technical now for most people. You know, back then you knew every part. I had cars that broke down so many times. I knew how to fix everything on them because it was like a Volkswagen. It was the same. You know, you knew where everything was.
Yeah.
But I couldn't. You know, if I open up a car engine now, I would be looking for a giant on-off switch.
It's like looking into a giant bread bin. I'm like, I don't. Yeah. Well, I remember that my first cars, and you got because I had so many shit cars. I knew what it sounded like when it was working well. So you'd be driving on, you go, hang on. And there'd be an odd noise. And like, shit. I better go and look at that. And going to scrap yards and climbing over the cars to get a starter motor.
Sure.
And I miss all that. You know, that nothing to do with being a man. It was just the fact that you could go and do that.
Yeah.
And we've lost all that. A more innocent time.
I suppose. Although, I don't think... The tendency of men to just want to take things apart and put them together again is ever going to go away. That's a natural. I'm watching my seven-year-old kid, you know, building Lego and just trying to make all kinds of things that he's seen on craft shows on TV. You know, it's just that doesn't go away. Yeah. You can't do it with cars anymore.
No, just do it with other stuff. That's a good point, actually. My lads were the same. My lads, I mean, they're 23 and 28 now. But yeah, when they were growing up, you'd buy them something and then you'd come back a week later and it was a bitch.
And you put that together and modified.
Yeah. like this has got four speakers now. And you have one.
The thing about cars back when I was, you know, when I was younger and you could have one is that not only could you work on them, but there was always something you could add to it to make it faster or a bit flashier or sound a bit better, you know. There was just, you know, stereophonic speakers in the back or a new tape deck or something, or mags, baby moons,
I remember there was a story when I was a kid of these lads that had put, it was the first time I'd heard of nitrous oxide, and they'd put in new seats in this car and they put the nitrous oxide in there as well, but they hadn't bolted the seats in properly. So when they hit the switch, the seats came out and they both ended up in the back. And I don't know if that was one of those urban legends.
Yeah.
Because that's it. That's the other thing as well, because the internet, you don't have those urban myths. There was that one about, it was only a film, they made a film of it, and they said the guy that attached a jet engine to his car.
Right.
And then off of a plane, and then the policeman's going, well, you see this, you see where the he said he was doing a burnout for like like 50 miles. He said, and he said, you see this gap here, you know where they stop? Well, that's where he left the ground. And that's what I love. I love those old stories. Yeah. And someone would always tell you that story as if it was a friend of a friend.
Right, yeah.
And I miss that.
Yeah, I know at least six people who claim they were. There's this very famous show business story about the comedian Red Fox, had been the star of Sanford and Son, which was based on a British show. I forget which one, but he's a Steptoe and Son. Or he's a garbage.
Oh yeah, yeah,
I know,
yeah.
He's a garbage man. Anyway, it was massively popular. But then he and it had a theme song that went. You know, with like a bat. And then he went to, then it was over and he started touring Vegas and he was in a showroom and there were only about like nine people there, but he had an orchestra that would play the theme song from Steptoe and Son. I mean, from Sanford and Son. And so they go, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Red Fox. Then he walked out and he went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 motherfuckers. I don't do a show for nine motherfuckers. Fuck you. Good night. Then the band played. Now there were nine people there, and I talked to at least six people who claimed they were at that show.
See, I love shit like that. It's like over here, everyone, it used to be old men would say that we had the gangsters, the craze. Yeah. And all the every time you met an old guy in a pub in the East End, you're like, yeah, I used to drive for the craze.
Right.
And then someone said, why, did they have a taxi firm? It's like 400 of you. But I'm sure the stories are still there. There'll be stories.
Oh, yeah.
There has to be, isn't there?
Yeah, there has to be.
There has to be, man. Rich, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on. I've had a really nice time talking to you. And I'll tell you this, we have met before once or twice. Right. I remember, you were the inspiration to me about, I shortened my name to Rich.
Oh.
Because of you. I was a big fan of you. And when I first started, there was a character called Victor Meldrew in One Foot in the Grave. And his catchphrase was, I don't believe it. And his real name is Richard Wilson. Oh, so I'd walk out and go, oh, it's Richard. And I'd get met with this barrage of, I don't believe it.
And then
I shortened it to Rich and it all went away. And it was all inspired by you. But what has happened, and it still happens to this day, people forget and they introduce me as Rich Hall.
All right.
And you've never seen a more disappointed bunch when I walk out and go, hey, and they go, nah, that's not the fucking dude.
Yeah.
So, you know, I still love it. Rich, thank you for coming on. Are you on the social media or anything like that? Or?
Kind of, marginally.
Yeah, okay. And have you got anything coming out that you need to plug?
No, nothing. if I give you a date, it'll get changed.
True, yeah. Very true. Rich, thank you for taking the time to come and talk to me. I really appreciate it, mate.
Alrighty.
Insane in the membrane.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Made by darkhorsedigital.co.uk. Shooting, live streaming, and podcast production.